Hello. Good morning. You all look so beautiful. So interesting, you know, we have a 9 o'clock service, and I sat up here 2 hours ago, and it was raining and cloudy, and now the sun's coming out, and I see fall colors. Fascinating, fascinating. You know, it's interesting because we're talking about impermanence this morning, which is one of the fundamental teachings of the Buddhist path, that everything is impermanent, and that a large part of our suffering in life, when we encounter suffering, is because we're resisting the impermanence. And, you know, it strikes me that sort of like, you know, we're on the verge of the autumn colors, right? And I used to drive up through Albany and over into Vermont every October to go see the fall colors. And one year I was meditating in the woods in Vermont, and I started reflecting on the fact that when we age, we start trying to make our bodies look like they're still young. And I thought, that's so interesting, because there's, you know, you look at like some of the greatest photographers, and some of their most amazing photos have been photos of Native Americans or elders in many different cultures who have, you know, just thousands of wrinkles in their faces, and they're so beautiful. And we Americans don't like that, see? And I thought, but we do like the fall colors. I thought, well, what if we, you know, when the fall colors came every year, we sent out teams of people to paint the leaves green again? Because, oh, we don't like change. Well, that's roughly our predicament, you know, as human beings resisting impermanence and resisting the way it is. And my sense has always been that embedded in the way it is the path to awakening, is the path to peace, is the path to love. It sort of has to be. Because my guru said that the universe is perfect, so I've never known him to be wrong. It's just that when I look at it, I don't see the perfection. Maybe it's a problem with my perception. What does that mean, that it's perfect? You know, I'm fascinated by the fact that a lot of young people, you go into a restaurant, young people come, person comes to serve you, and whatever you order, they go, perfect! I'm tempted to say, well, I hope it's perfect. If it isn't, I'll be speaking to the chef. Do we know what that means? That's a really, you know, perfect, 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 perfect. Anyone been looking at the news the last few weeks? Perfect? Perfect? Houston perfect? Florida perfect? Puerto Rico? Dominica? Barbuda? Perfect? Las Vegas? Perfect? What do we do with that? You know, years ago when I, at Ram Dass' suggestion, went to study with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who was an amazing psychiatrist who started to introduce us to the idea that we humans actually die. She was a doctor. She first was trying to teach the medical profession. It doesn't matter how good you get, it still seems to end up that way. And it struck me as so interesting because that was something that we had always fought against acknowledging and fought against looking at. And yet I started to meet people who said, I've never felt as alive as I do since I realized I'm dying. What does that mean? Wow. And then we found ourselves starting to feel envious of people in an odd way. I wrote a whole story in When Prayers Aren't Answered about a fellow that I met in Tallahassee, Florida. He was a young attorney with a very promising career. And he was one of the first people who told me that. He had a wife and a child. He was very sad about leaving them, but he also said, you know, I've never experienced this kind of vibrancy in my life. And Stephen Levine ultimately wrote a book called A Year to Live, which our beloved Patricia helped to lead a course about. And I think Sandesh. Is Sandesh here? There he is. Namaste. But the idea being that what would life look like if we embraced inevitable change rather than resisted it? How would we live differently? How would we think differently? How would we feel differently? How would we look at the world differently? Instead of pretending that it's other than it is. Because it is the way it is. I mean, and there's two different forces happening. We can look at the things that human beings do, like Las Vegas. We can look at the things that nature does. Mother Nature, is she punishing us? You know, I mean, it's sort of like, I remember when I was about 12 years old, 10 years old, I was in Atlantic City, and a hurricane named Hurricane Donna came through. And I remember just standing there witnessing the awesome power of it. And instead of being frightened, I was just fascinated, awestruck. Because I was probably too young and dumb to realize I should be frightened. But I saw this beauty in it. It was just extraordinary. And the ocean, you know, we were in an apartment on the beach, right on the boardwalk in Atlantic City. And in those days, I don't know now, but the beach was huge. It was like about 100 yards from the boardwalk to the water's edge. And now during the storm, the waves were breaking over the boardwalk. And much of the boardwalk went out to sea when the waves receded. And there were fish in the swimming pool. And I just stood there going, wow, that is amazing. I had no sense that we were being punished. It was just nature doing one of the things that nature does. And maybe, you know, we might be wise not to live so close to the ocean. You know, maybe the problem is not that we're being punished. Maybe the problem is that we're not acknowledging what is. You know? Stop building on the wetlands. Yeah, well, that's a whole other thing. Oh, God. We don't have time for that right now. But it's true, you know? It's true. We build in places where, you know, I hate to say it, because there's profit to be made, we do reckless things with our planet and our society. So the law of impermanence, realizing that nothing lasts, nothing, including these bodies. Now, if that's the case, I want to try to draw a distinction between when our minds perceive something as wrong and when we're fighting with what is. In other words, most of the time, we're dealing with situations in the past. Now, all of those storms and the event in Las Vegas are in the past. And we're fighting against it with our minds. But it is what is. The new, you know, Ram Dass used to have this great phrase that he would say when something unexpected happened. He would say, new moment. You know, somebody inherited a bunch of money. Hey, new moment. Somebody's house was destroyed by a flood. New moment. In one there's joy, in one there's suffering. He used to fly a lot. He said, you know, airports are full of new moments. If you fly, you really understand that. You never know. You walk into the airport, you have no idea what's going to transpire in the next few hours or where you're going to wind up. Maybe sleeping on the floor of the airport. Or one time I was flying home from Los Angeles and something was going on. Vice President Cheney at the time was at Newark Airport and nobody could land. So we wound up at Stewart Airport in Newburgh, which was fun. I was happy because Patricia lived there at the time and I thought, well, at least I got a place to stay. So, you know, there's so many interesting spiritual stories that illustrate it. One of my favorites is a story of Nasruddin, who was a great Sufi prankster. So Nasruddin is the guy who, he was always having fun. Great Sufi saint, and one day he went into the bank, and they said, he handed them a check that he wanted to cash, and the teller looked at it, and he looked at Nasruddin, who was a little shaky looking, and he said, well, the check looks all right, but sir, can you identify yourself? Nasruddin reached in his pocket, he pulled out a little mirror, and he looked in, and he said, yeah, that's me. The other favorite story about Nasruddin was that he was a smuggler. And he was smuggling something on donkeys going across the border from the adjoining country into his country. And the border guys knew, but they could never figure out. He'd come through with a donkey, you know, was just covered with boxes and bags of stuff. And the customs people would stop him, and they'd go through all the boxes and bags and everything, and they'd just look in the donkey's mouth, and they were so frustrated. You could never find out what the contraband was that he was crossing the border with. One day, years later, he ran into one of the border guards in the tavern, of course, and the border guard saw him and said, oh, Nasruddin, you got to tell me. Before I die, I really must know. You completely buffaloed us. What were you smuggling? Nasruddin said, donkeys. So the story that's pertinent to our talk this morning is that one day his neighbor had this wonderful set of pots, and Nasruddin came over, and he said, I'm having a big party. A bunch of friends of mine are coming over. I need to borrow your big pot so I can cook a big soup. And the neighbor said, oh, no, Nasruddin, are you kidding me? I'll never see this pot again. Nasruddin said, no, I promise, I'll bring it back, don't worry. Well, he finally just badgers the guy, talks him into it, so he loans him the big pot. And Nasruddin takes the pot home. The next day he brings it back all spiffed up and shiny and clean, and everything's fine. He says, thank you very much for the use of your pot, it was beautiful. you know, made a great soup. Everybody was happy. Neighbors surprised. Oh, great. Next week, Nasruddin comes back and he says, I'm having another party. Can I borrow your pot again? The man says, sure. Gives it to him. He takes it. Next day, Nasruddin doesn't show up. No pot, no Nasruddin. 2 days, no pot, no Nasruddin. A whole week passes. Nasruddin hasn't come back with the pot. Man finally goes over to Nasruddin's house, knocks on the door, and he says, Nasruddin, where is my pot? Nasruddin hangs his head. He says, I've been trying to figure out how to tell you. While your pot was at my house, it died. Man looks at him, he says, Nasruddin, pots don't die. Well, see, there's another story that I told at the retreat, which I won't tell again. But our predicament is that everything in the world of form can die. That being the case, that everything in the world of form changes, then we take our experience of life and use it to remind us of the most important things in life, which are to be awake, to be loving, to be fully present in our lives, to be joyful. How to do that in the face of suffering? That's really the challenge of our spiritual life. And to remember that those states, all of them, love, peace, joy, all like coming home, because that is who we truly are in our hearts. We are love and peace and joy. You may not believe that in many moments in life. Here's a statement from Swami Vivekananda. He said, we are the infinite being of the universe and have become materialized into these little beings, men and women, depending on the sweet word of one man or the angry word of another, and so forth. What a terrible dependence. What a terrible slavery. I, who am beyond all pleasure and pain, whose reflection is the whole universe, little bits of whose life are the suns and moons and stars. I am held down as a terrible slave. If you pinch my body, I feel pain. If one says a kind word, I begin to rejoice. See my condition, slave of the body, slave of the mind, slave of the world, slave of a good word, slave of a bad word. Slave of passion, slave of happiness, slave of life, slave of death, slave of everything. This slavery has to be broken. So I think the point is that in dealing with impermanence, in dealing with change, in dealing with the things we don't like in the world, the only thing we can do is go into our own heart and find the love and peace and equanimity that exist in our own heart. Because everything around us is going to change. Sometimes we'll like the changes, right? Oh, some of them are good. We were talking about meditation over the weekend, and several people were talking about the challenge of meditation, which is, you know, sometimes you meditate and meditate and meditate and nothing seems to be happening. And then you may meditate and all of a sudden, woo, wow, great, oh man, this is wonderful. And of course, when that happens, a little voice in your mind says, how do I keep this going all the time? How do I see to it that every time I sit down and meditate, I go, woo, wow, great, oh. And then you struggle and struggle and struggle. And it's that little thing in the mind that wants your experience to be different than it is. And when you settle into the experience as it is, that paves the way for you to sort of surreptitiously slide into, ooh, wow, oh, yeah. Because the resistance starts to fall away. The resistance to the way things are. It's one of the things we do when we work with pain in meditation. And we see that the most of the pain is actually the resistance to the pain, the resistance to a sensation that we don't like, a sensation that frightens us. So our path is to soften the resistance. Soften the resistance. What, you know the phrase, whatever we resist persists, gets stronger. So what I want to leave with you today, and you can join us from 1 to 3 if you like. We'll continue this discussion. We'll do some meditation exercises and reflections on how to deal with the things that frighten us in life, how to deal with the things that we find unacceptable in life, how to be at peace no matter what happens, so that we don't have to run out and paint the leaves green again, so that we can enjoy and see the beauty in the change. So we will be doing that this afternoon right here. We'd love to have you join us. But know that when you come here on Sunday mornings, when you sit in meditation, whenever you have that feeling of that's in you. Whatever peace you feel here in this sacred place is in you. So don't leave it here. Take it with you out into the world, to your homes, to your families, to where you work. Live in the space of peace and love and joy that is your true heart. Namaste.